Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Marianne Wolfe. She is the John DiBiagio Professor of Citizenship and Public Service at Tufts University, and currently directs the Center for Dyslexia, Diverse Learners, and Social Justice at UCLA, and is working with the Dyslexia Center at the UCSF School of Medicine, and with Curious Learning, a global literacy project which she co-founded. And we're talking about her new book, Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. Marianne, welcome back. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
And to you too, Mark. I was looking forward to this.
This book is so important. I've been throwing it in people's faces Because, you know, all throughout this book, I really felt deeply that as a society, we've already arrived at the things that you're worried about in this book.
Yeah. The reality is that when you write a book like this, you've written it a year or 2 years. And then by the time you want to turn it in, you see reality around you. Hoped wouldn't happen, but already has.
It's like the worst predictions of this book came true already.
They are, yeah.
Let's talk about the book because there's so much to talk about. And again, for the benefit of the audience, I cannot recommend this book enough. Please read this book. One of the first things I want people to know is that our brain is not pre-wired for reading, correct?
Yes, and as you and I spoke 10 years ago, Mark, about Proust,
it seems like
the
only
work
yesterday.
That went into Proust, I know it feels so, Proust and the Squid, the first line of that book was, we were never meant to read. And by that I meant, and that sentence has been a boon companion for me because it's such a simple insight, but an important one for people to realize. We don't have anything pre-wired, genetically programmed for reading. We have it for language, for taste, smell, sight, thinking, feeling, but we have to create a whole new circuit for reading, which is both its great strength and its Achilles heel in a digital world.
And as he wrote in this book, and this is the thing that really grabbed me, is that while you're writing this book, you realize that reading had changed in the course of the last 10 years since you wrote the previous book.
Absolutely. I had been very concerned, and the last chapter I actually had to rewrite in Proust and the Squid because I could see the realities around me were already making my concerns very visible, but they hadn't quite happened. But you're absolutely correct, Mark. All the things that I thought were concerns have in fact become our reality. And one of the things that I wrote about in myself in this fourth letter was that I never thought that I would be just as, if you will, vulnerable.
Oh my God, that was a weird. we'll talk about that, but I want to mention that every chapter is, in fact, a letter to the reader.
Yeah.
It makes it very personal.
Well, I wanted it to be, Mark, because of a whole set of reasons. The first being a kind of homage, if you will, to Rainer Maria Rilke, the poet, who wrote this beautiful book, Letters to a Young Poet. And the reason why I was so impressed by that book and why it influenced this one was because he was writing to this young man who obviously he would never meet, and yet he wrote with such a tender regard for him that I thought, what a great model for an author to look at their readers. And so the letter became my template, if you will, for having an openness to the potential of the reader, not just to look at my knowledge as a kind of a gift, but as a dialogue. And especially in the areas that I cover in this book, there is no last word by the author. There is much more of a dialogue between author and some readers will have vastly more knowledge than I do about technological innovations that are happening already. So I wanted it to be both a a letter form for the tender regard between author right. and reader, but even more so a dialogue with no last word.
There are several things I want to get to because I want to make sure we mention some of the major points.
Sure.
Reading online is not the same as sitting in your comfy chair reading a book. And that's an experience, and it's an experience I know well. That's an experience you call deep reading. You're alone. You're in a chair. You cuddle up with the book, literally, and you lose sense of time and place.
And you lose sense of yourself, too. You move into someone else's shoes.
It ends up that that experience is not the same experience at all as when people are reading online.
Right. And therein lies a complex story with many disciplines now trying to unpack the differences. Now, my particular perspective is more as a cognitive neuroscientist, but I'm working with and always learning from people in literary studies who are looking at this from their perspective. From my own, there's no question now that the research shows us that when you're looking at a screen, you are having a circuit, that's that reading brain that we possess, that we build, that circuit is going to reflect the characteristics or affordances of the medium. So the medium of a book, which is kinesthetic, which is very very tactile, concrete, gives you a lot of spatial information, that experience actually has affordances or characteristics which give you extra time to allocate to deep reading processes. On the other hand, the screen, the internet, but especially the internet, is this, if you will, this this set of characteristics that hasten us, that speed us so that we are able to process the volume of information, which can run between 50 and 100,000 words a day. So we are necessarily having to change our reading style when we're bombarded with this much stimuli. But the problem is that skimming becomes the modus operandi, the norm, if you will, for our reading, which doesn't allocate time to the deep reading processes or the sense of immersion that the other form of reading does.
And again, you have to read this book to understand all the research that goes behind things that we're talking about. Deep reading helps develop things like critical thinking, personal reflection, imagination, and here's the big one for me, empathy.
I knew you would say it. That's such an important aspect of the reading process that your average person never even thinks about. They might think about critical analysis, and I certainly would hope that they would, but by and large, most people don't realize that reading is like a moral laboratory. That's a line from a wonderful European researcher named Frank Hockemolder, and he calls it a moral laboratory. Theologians call it the vehicle for passing over, theologians like John Donne, but all of them are pointing to the fact that when we read, we don't just think, but we take on the perspective of another person.
Right.
That's when we even listen to a mother or a father reading Frog and Toad or George and Martha. But when we actually read it ourselves, we spend even more time giving ourselves over, not just to understanding the feelings of another, but what is called in psychology research, theory of mind. We are like mini Machiavellians in a certain sense in there. So it's not all, you know, roses and sunshine. It's figuring out how another person thinks. But that in turn, with our understanding of how another person feels, gives us a whole new venue into perspective taking of others and awakens us to empathy in various forms. And there's a lot of great work, including by my colleague at Boston College, Ellen Winner, on the different forms of empathy. In neuroscience, the people like Tanya Singer in Germany are doing all this research in which they're showing that we really have an awful lot of our brain activated when we are taking on the perspective of another. It's cognitive and affective together.
Right. Absolutely. And we're experiencing right now, as a culture, a decline of empathy.
Yeah, there's some very worrisome studies, especially in the young, by Sarah Conrath at Stanford, and Sherry Turkle articulates this beautifully. But basically, we're seeing in one of the studies, which is very qualitative, so I want to say we need a lot of replications, but now we've got study after another suggesting that the empathy of our young is on decline, and as we get closer to the present, even more so. So it's not like the decline over 20 years happened in the beginning and now that people are connected, that they are showing, you know, it's on an upswing. It's the converse.
There's so many great quotes in your book, by the way, and that's one of the real joys of it, is to read all these quotes. But there's a great quote from C.S. Lewis on page 45. We read to know that we are not alone.
We are not alone. It's so beautiful. And do you know, one of the things that always almost hurts me is that people are saying, oh, reading is selfish, reading is solitary. Oh my goodness. Reading is the opposite of that. Reading is when we go into ourselves and leave ourselves. We understand others. And actually, when I think of not just C.S. Lewis, but even, and I go back to Machiavellian letters to people at the time, he would put on the manner of dress that person he was reading once wore to read. So, I mean, this is like the acting out of the dialogue that happens, which was another reason for the letter. I really want people to understand there's such a personal aspect in the reading process that people, I think, just don't appreciate sufficiently.
Deep reading and I'm only touching on a few of the points that you make in this book. It requires cognitive patience, that idea that you slow it down. And by slowing cognitive processes down, you're allowing a lot of other things to develop. You're able to do things like analogical reasoning is developing, inference. Again, we've talked about empathy, but all that requires time. And by having the input of sitting there in the chair reading, that is what it's going on in your brain. This is not an abstract thing. We're talking about an actual physical thing that's happening in your brain that's not occurring otherwise.
Well, this is where our world is at this, what I use Robert Darnton's expression, hinge moment. I believe we are at a moment when our science and our technology, unlike other moments where communication changes dramatically, we now have the science and technology to look at ourselves and say, what are we going to do about this?
Right.
Now, deep reading can occur online. It can occur with a screen, but it doesn't easily because the affordances of the screen, even when we think we're slowing ourselves down to really think carefully, even though we think we're doing this, by and large, the bleeding over of that skimming modality is making us less likely to allocate time. Now, when I say
can I stop you there? Because I think just by looking at a screen, you feel like you're you've got a short time budget. You know, just the very fact of like holding that that iPhone in your hand or the iPad, you feel like, I've got a lot of other stuff to do. I'm going to do this.
Well, this is the problem. And this is something that's really important for our listeners to understand. It is not that one cannot use deep reading processes. It's that they are not advantaged on the screen because we have a set. You know, you go into a movie and you expect something to occur on a screen that moves rapidly. Well, the same thing, but in even a more dramatic way, when we look at a screen, we are thinking the next, the next, the next.
That's right.
In part, especially if we're on a computer screen on the internet, because we are also being distracted. So there's a double whammy. If we're on the internet, we are both distracted by novel stimuli to the left, to the right, which are not allowing us to focus. But if we're even on a Kindle, we still have that set, just as you've said, to we've got to move on. And in fact, the screen moves us on. And we don't have that spatial knowledge that the kinesthetic book. If you think about it, you know where you just gave me the C.S. Lewis quote. Or give me another quote with Toni Morrison. Into the book, to the right, two-thirds to the bottom. So I could tell you spatially where these things are. Well, there's none of that.
That's right. Well, you know, I can tell you what happens when I'm reading a book like yours, and I wish we had TV screens. Because I'm underlining and writing things in the margins, that slows me down incredibly because I have to think about something. And then that thought is fixed in my brain. Let me just do this break. Right. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight, returning, Marianne Wolfe. She is the John DiBiagio Professor of Citizenship and Public Service at Tufts University, currently directs the Center for Dyslexia and Diverse Learners and Social Justice at UCLA. She's working with the Dyslexia Center at UCSF and School of Medicine, and with Curious Learning, a global literacy project which she co-founded. I don't think she's busy enough. We were also talking about her new book, Reader, Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. And this is where it gets really, for me, got really weird. Because you yourself in this book, while you're writing it, started to think about your own reading mind.
Yes. It was a wake-up
call. That scared the crap out of me.
was very disconcerting. You know, there's all kinds of dis words, but disconcerting, discomforting, disappointing.
So you go to sit down to read one of your favorite novels, Hermann Hesse's The Glass Bead Game.
Yeah.
And what happened?
Well, it had been, notice the syntactic structure, it had been one of my favorite novels as a graduate student, and I had been thinking at that moment, I was doing a master's in English literature, and I was thinking about going on in German literature. So Hermann Hesse was very important to me. Glass Bead Game was one of the reasons why he won the Nobel Prize for Literature, etc. So I thought, this will be a good almost case study of myself to see how I've changed or whether I, unlike all my readers, I haven't changed. My deep reading is intact. Well, it was a truly terrible experience. I knew the plot. It wasn't like I had any suspense. That was the problem. It was the fact that I was taking my normal mode of reading, which is the one that is a function of being on the screen like everybody else, 6 to 12 hours a day. And I was trying to read it in the same way that I was reading on the screen. But I assumed I wouldn't do that. I assumed that because I read a lot of novels, this beautiful piece, which I had loved, would be a piece of cake. Instead, the complexity, the density, the 1940s style, everything conspired against me. And it was, I've said this, it was almost like pouring molasses over my cortex. I just didn't, I couldn't read it. I tried and I went my normal pace and nothing good came out of it. I was so disgusted, another dis word, that I just said, this is not working.
This section of the book actually frightened me.
Yeah, well, it frightened the heck out of me.
And you conveyed that. We're going to run out of time here, and I knew this because we're not going to talk about most of the...
But I have to tell people the good ending.
Yeah, you did have a happy ending.
Okay, the happy ending is something for everyone, which is I thrust the book back, and then I said, I can't do this. Hermann Hesse is my friend. He helped build me. And so I went back and I forced myself to read only 20 minutes book in hand, chair in a corner, only 20 minutes, and I consciously slowed myself down to the pace of the book's demands. And after 2 weeks, that's where the home comes in. I came home to my former reading self. It took 2 full weeks. I want the readers to know, or the listeners to know this. It was not a quick and easy fix. It was trying to get back to that immersive quality of reading, which I thought I had not lost, but I had.
What this is meaning, and you point this out in the book, is the choice of reading materials now by people is affected, and also what people, what's being written. People, you wrote an incredible, there are college level professors who cannot get their students to read novels.
Exactly. The novels of the 19th and early 20th century. Even to this moment, I'm getting letters from my other book, Proust and the Squid, from professors of English literature who said they don't want to read Henry James. They don't want to read Melville. And some of these same people are literally giving their students short stories instead. So, as I said, I love Hemingway. Hemingway is
who wrote the shortest novel? I've always wanted to see if I could cut it down to five. But you know, one of the experiences by reading and other times and other ways to write, and as it's quoted in your book, the rich, expansive, unflattened use of language, is that, for instance, there's a phrase in your book, like the ill-fated Procrustean bed. I always tumble over that. Most people won't understand that reference.
Oh, it's so true. This is the,
and
this
by the way, really, if you don't know the Procrustean bed story, that's a weird story. That's a really weird mythological story.
It's weird, but second, it's part of our cultural heritage.
Well, it used to be.
But Mark, everywhere, I just came back from the 100th anniversary of an Italian press that they're doing a month on celebrating the book because they're so worried about its demise. They're worried about the future of the book, the future of the reader, and they are worried that the reader will not understand so many of the metaphors, similes, references to mythology, references even to the Bible. You know, this is a heritage that you don't have to be an elitist. You just have to have a shared cultural history of literature and poetry and mythology that we want to pass on. It makes life so much more meaningful. We have layers of meaning instead of, as you referenced, the Calvino, the flattened kind of language that we may be headed towards.
That's like the language of 1980, the novel 1984. That's where we're headed for.
Yeah,
and that means we're very prone, because you get your critical thinking skills from deep reading. That means it's very easy to have a totalitarian society with people who don't read.
Well, one of the, I think, the most profound realizations I had to make, and I had to rewrite this several times to get this right, so that I was not offending the readers I wanted to read this. I do not want to offend anyone, but the reality is this skimming mode has reduced our ability to take material that goes against our own perspective.
Right.
It's too much. We go comfort. We go least challenging material. We go to information that's unadjudicated, and therefore we have become so susceptible not only to false information, but falsely raised fears, falsely raised hopes, and even in narratives that, even though people would ordinarily think, oh, that, you know, that really has no basis in fact, they're willing to suspend because they aren't putting the effort in to critically analyze what's being written and said by people who are in high places in our world.
Now, we're not going to have time to talk. Now, people are going to be surprised after all this conversation. You actually recommend that we develop a two-tiered approach to reading in children,
yes.
Which is that's a very important mission for you. The classical reading, the deep reading, and then along with that, a critical approach to digital reading. And people are going to have to pick up the book for that, because we're virtually out of time. But you actually recommend, you talk about digital reading at the end of the last third of the book and make recommendations on how we can teach that. And you have recommendations all over the place. It's just whether we have the will to do that. But I want to talk about the last phrase of the book, because it was so cool. Festina lente.
Ah, yes.
What does it mean?
One of the most beautiful aspects of this little phrase is to hasten slowly, to make haste slowly. And it is an oxymoron. It is a contradiction in terms, but it is exactly what I want the readers to do. I want them, their reading brain, to move rapidly enough so that it can allocate time to the slower, deliberative processes. So Festina Lenta was both a metaphor for the reading brain itself, what it has to do to give us deep reading, and it was also a commentary on our lives. We go so fast, but for what? I want us to go quickly, but not forget why we're going and moving so quickly. I want us to move into the contemplative function that the human being has and possesses, but I believe is losing quickly, to go back to the quick. So I really see reading, and this Festina Lenta was not the very last word. Festina Lenta, dear and good reader.
That's right. That's right.
Come home. And then the very last word, other than my name, was Godspeed. And it's the only, if you will, spiritual message that I wish to give, and that is that we need to get out of ourselves. Whatever religious tradition or non-tradition or atheism, it doesn't matter. But the very notion of Godspeed is that we can lift ourselves out of ourselves to contemplate the beauty of our lives that are going so quickly by that we are not appreciating them. And reading gives us the vehicle to that appreciation. It's so inexpensive and efficient a means of looking at our lives.
With that, I thank you. My guest tonight has been Marianne Wolfe. She is the John DiBiagio Professor of Citizenship and Public Service at Tufts University. She currently directs the Center for Dyslexia, Diverse Learners, and Social Justice at UCLA. She's working on the Dyslexia Center at UCSF and School of Medicine, and with Curious Learning, a global literacy project. But we've been talking about Reader, Come Home, the reading brain in a digital world. Marianne, we can't wait another 10 years to talk.
Thank you, Mark. It would be my pleasure.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.